So within Deep Time Network, we were invited to do an action project. I designed a thing called Ecozoic Wisdom Circle. Ecozoic is Thomas Berry's word for what we need to move into as a species and in the globe. So we've got Paleozoic, very ancient, Mesozoic, somewhere in the middle, and we are currently in what's called the Cenozoic, which means the new Zoic era. But actually, we need the Ecozoic era, the one that we are about to move into. So I moved across to the Centre for Ecozoic Studies, did a year-long project in a thing called Humans and the Biosphere. Group of lovely women and a few men, and my project had a pilot wisdom circle, which I report on in my paper in full, but can't report on in a 10-minute TED talk. So an Ecozoic Wisdom Circle, you'll see from that next paragraph, is a small group who choose to focus together on their everyday lives, drawing on learning from all times, all creatures, and all places. Whew, who do you think you are, Daishira? So eco as house and zoic as life calls for an evolution to home of life with a view to the incoming era. So these circles focus on a spirituality for life on Earth, and they're a means of cultivating contemplative conversation across the polarised and diverse views of spirituality within the contemporary world. And Berry's recommended sources are Indigenous wisdom, the wisdom of women, the wisdom of science, and the wisdom of the classical traditions, which I'll now demonstrate. So out of my humans and the biosphere thing, everybody told me, you've created a framework. I didn't set out to do it, so I said, great, we'll call it that. Thank you. On the left-hand side of your diagram, we know from science now that from the geosphere, the biosphere evolved, so life started much, much later than the geosphere was formed. And, thank you, all living beings within their ecosystems. Now, thank you, we are evolving towards a thing called the noosphere, coined by Teilhard de Chardin and another Polish guy, Vedansky. Hello. Yikes. I've already said there's so much in common, so thank you for coming. So, thank you. So, we are evolving that at the current moment. Teilhard's idea was there is a thin film around the globe and that it is converging on itself. True? I mean, we're very diversified, but we're actually moving towards a oneness and an instantaneousness that hasn't been part of human culture before. So the noosphere comes from the two words, and it's more than mind. It is a heart mind, a consciousness of some kind that we're still learning. And we're going to evolve it, strengthen it, and stabilise it, hopefully, in Ecozoic Wisdom Circles. So the sources of wisdom recommended by Thomas Berry, which I mentioned to you just now, first one is science. Did I give you... Yes, I did. Yes, okay. Thank you. So there you are. One aspect of this is taking on board all the science that has now landed in our laps, things that we think we have proof of until we find a better way of explaining it. The next source is the wisdom of women, which for me, in the process of running this pilot circle, became sourcing the divine feminine, a sense of presence within that group that wasn't there out of just a pure cognitive consciousness. The classical traditions are also one of Thomas Berry's suggested sources of wisdom. And for me, that is the mystics across the faiths, the Sufi mystics, the Christian mystics, and all sorts of things that come out of India. And finally, the source of indigenous wisdom. Thank you. So what is going to synthesize these? What is going to enable us to bring these together? And the answer is, in Teilhard's vocabulary, complexity consciousness, everything is becoming more and more, and in Beatrice Bruto's terms, communion consciousness. So a sense of oneness in our feeling, thinking, being together. What have I got next? So there's the beautiful picture that some of you have got in colour and others have got in black and white. And basically, my paper will take you through some of the ideas that I've explored. I went across it this morning to see what I needed to also add. Teilhard talks about a planetary contraction. So we often think of the future going like that. But Teilhard's view was we're actually merging towards an omega point. We are converging together. And, yeah, I won't read that. It will take too long. I'll run out of time. So I have three sections in my paper. First of all, experiencing wisdom as personal presence. That came across practically in two of us going, there are not four of us here, there are five of us. And others having their own terminology for that. And I called her Lady Wisdom in a Christian sense. But Sophia in Hebrew scriptures, Shakti in Hinduism, and even in Islam, some things around the divine feminine are present. So the key question as four of us met was, what is happening for you in this now, in this moment? Not we're going to solve something, but what is the sense that's arising within you? Share it, listen to each other, and see where that takes us. And, of course, I've forgotten to tell you that my wisdom circles, I try to get one person from each of those four sources, an Indigenous person. So we had Seema Shalini from India, Jewish person from New York, myself with a Christian background, and someone who grew up Christian but is a natural theology person, laying on of hands, no faith now at the moment that she can express in terms with a label. And so what oneness or wholeness do you sense in what's being brought into the floor of that wisdom circle? As facilitator, I'm watching to see which of the four perspectives are being ignored or overlooked. And what's the invitation as we move forward? So I've already done a mega point. And in one of the quotes that you'll find in my paper, the greater contact we have with life within ourselves, interiority, the wider the space we can relate to others from. So it's not an introspection that has no relevance socially or spiritually. It is the more we get deep here, the wider we are able to relate to one another. That must be 1 minute. So I'll just point you to the paragraph, and as I did the paper, I thought, dare I say this? But you can see where I got to. I see this work as a new application of the going into all the world of Matthew's commission, and a way of accompanying others held within the promise of the Christ. Because Teilhard's view is that the noosphere will become the Christosphere. So it's not just that global thing, it is also Christ as person and universe as person. That's going to be the end point. I see some frowns, but that's okay. You have to do that with Tahath. Lo, I am with you to the end of the age, said Jesus. We are called not to preach a sectarian gospel, but to immerse others in the waters of baptism, a symbol of dying and rising to new life, and to teach the love that is the greatest commandment. I think sometimes we forget that's what Jesus said. In Delio's terms, we emerge from the whole, we belong to the whole, we are endowed with the capacity to evolve to higher levels of complexity and consciousness. And in Teilhard's terms, amongst the various forms of psychic interaction which animate the noosphere, there is, therefore, it is the intercentric energies that we have above all to identify, to harness and to develop if we would make an effective contribution to the progress of evolution within ourselves. In other words, the problem to which this all leads us is the problem of love and how to define that in the modern world. Thank you. Now, at your table, just have a chat to see if all four of those wisdom sources are represented or not. Is anyone here of Indigenous heritage? This is the weakness in my project, to find Indigenous people and to find how we resource that effectively. But are there at least three of those wisdom sources at your table? Is there a scientist? Is there a woman? Is there someone with a religious tradition? Is there someone with a religious tradition other than Christianity? That would be helpful, wouldn't it? Good, good, okay. So why don't you now at your table just go into the contemplative self that you know all about, because this is a spirituality conference. And when you feel like something is emerging that needs saying around your table, just say it to the others and listen to it. Let's do that for 5 minutes, a mini practice ecozoic wisdom circle. What is it arising in you that wants to be spoken now?
Do we have time for any quick feedback? 30 seconds? Anyone got any?
We've got one from June. Which
yes?
What holds me back? Well, it's thinking that I have to be an expert.
Yes.
And so just I love that invitation to be, I'm not the expert.
Yeah.
Journey with you and
yeah.
Work with
yeah.
I love the presentation. It's great.
Thank you.
It's so practical great. In real life rather than all up.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. But if you read my paper, it's a little bit in the head. But but I've got those stories there too. Good.
Well, Mark, thank you very much indeed. And just to remind everyone indeed, let's show our appreciation to Mark. We're having our third paper, but also for those who have been in here, there's an opportunity to interact with speakers at the end of the third paper too. So if you've got questions for... the speakers. Please hold them until the end. And I'm delighted to welcome Professor Matthew Wickman to speak in a moment. I'll allow a little bit of changeover momentarily. We'll start in 30 seconds or so. Matthew, you're most welcome. Where are you from, Matthew?
I live in the state of Utah, and I'm from California.
Great. Great to have you here in Australia with us. And
thank you.
I meant to say that for others who'd spoken where they're from. We'll do that from now on, but you're welcome. Thanks for your presentation.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Since we're small, do you mind if I sit? Is that all right? Is that okay? Variation, right? So thank you. It's great to be here in Australia. It's great to have heard Mark, thank you, and Di, who left. It's great to be able to kind of just be here at this conference and to share from your spirits. I'm a literature professor. That's my job in the United States. And I see literature as perhaps our most sophisticated technology for encrypting and helping us to decipher spiritual meaning. Okay, it's an incredibly attuned and alert way to sort of capture the diastole and systole of spiritual life. And what I want to do today is introduce you to a remarkable poet, talk about some of her poetry, and talk about this another feature of literature, which is it can have a mind of its own that does not necessarily comport it to our intentions or our wishes, and what that means for this work of this author. This is two books here by, and these are just basically, they're here more or less as just exhibits to show, Laura Reese Hogan. This is a book of theology called I Live No Longer I, Paul's Spirituality of Suffering, Transformation, and Joy. It won four Catholic Press Association awards in 2017 when it was published. And this is her book of poems, Litany of Flights, published in 2020, that won the inaugural Paraclete Poetry Prize. So she's an accomplished and award-winning theologian and poet. And I think that she wants these two books to say the same kind of thing. And to some extent, they do. They're very complementary. But they act to different ends. And I find that to be a significant fact that can sort of shed some light on some things spiritually. The book, I Live No Longer I, the handout that you have gives a couple of sort of just like four different quotes. The first couple come from that book. It's a book that asks how we can sort of find God in the midst of the biggest challenges or difficulties that we face in life. And Laura distills down a pattern she finds for how God works with us there. The pattern is of three steps, dance steps, if you will, perhaps, or progressions. Kenosis, enosis, theosis, which is to say the first one is a self-emptying, where we kind of open ourselves to God as a function of being shaken out of some kind of habit or sensibility. It's the first one. Enosis, then, is entering into some kind of communion with God. God's presence is with us. We become more open to God's presence in our lives on a more consistent basis. And then theosis is what happens in a discipled life over time, that we're transformed over time. Right? Her poetry wants to say much the same thing, and it does say much the same thing. But the poems act differently. The poems don't really give us a window onto what theosis actually feels like, I think, or what it actually entails. Instead, the poems strike us with a force of spiritual vocation in the moment. They're very they strike us in a way that startles us into an awareness of the presence of God, not so much giving us an effect of the long-term presence of God over time. To that end, look at a couple of poems here. I'll read, and during the discussion at the end, maybe we can read the third one together. These are part of the handout that you have, if you have a handout. The first poem is the poem Earth on Fire. Earth on Fire, which I'll read here for us. Poetry's best read aloud, really. Earth on Fire. A haze of smoke hangs high, a red-eyed canopy of uncertain danger. Strange, yet more and more familiar with each passing news cycle as day follows brittle day. Drought has pressed grass into crunchy brown scrub, plum trees into tinder, heartbeats of the Phoebe into a clattering for water, seed, relief. Yet what comes is fire. Relentless inferno, licking red tongues of destruction, flames clasping hands with scorching Scirocco winds, outstripping jackrabbits, incinerating chaparral, walnuts, oaks, all one in the blazing terror of wild, consuming hunger. The wisdom of birds grows silent. Yet, did you not say you came to set the earth on fire? Now listen to what was up behind. The very soil lies coal black, hills turned to ash, to nothing, every contour bared in mourning, broken only by harsh, bony fingers of ebony oak corpse stabbing through the side of moonscape. Yet did you not say you wished it were already blazing? Let me tell you what I see there on the shoulders of the charred foothills. What was fire and death and the end has become a new Jerusalem. She is shadowed, yet beautiful. She says, "Do not stare at me because I am dark, because living fire has burned me." What flames have turned ash, the beloved embraces. What lies barren births anew, a shared open heart. Suffering yet transformed, transforming, still in bride clothes. A seed lies there, one that only knows to break open at the caress of its natural mother, fire. It's a beautiful poem, right, that tries to communicate and does it very beautifully communicate something about this process she describes in this book here, Theology. Kenosis, something broken open here. Here, the land broken open by fire, right? A sense of enosis, God's presence, those parenthetical asides where the poet has a sense recalling to mind things that God has spoken in Scripture. They give a sense for how the poet makes sense of ravaging destruction in relation to learned lines of Scripture and recollection. And also theosis, right? A sense that there's transformation occurring here as a function of the fire. But the energy of the poem isn't so much about the pattern per se, especially not of change over time, but the energy of the poem really is in these moments of epiphany, right? Moments like when there are these parenthetical asides, you know, where suddenly something comes to mind in the midst of destruction. Or that the unrhymed couplet at the very end, right? A seed lies there, one that only knows to break open at the caress of its natural mother, fire. So what's destructive is also what gives birth to new life. There's an ambiguity here and a tension between what is destructive and creative that opens the mind to a new way of thinking and seeing the situation. Take one more poem. I'll leave the middle one, maybe for our discussion. If you will, go to the poem that is titled The Filling Tree, which I think is just a gorgeous poem. And here's that poem, The Filling Tree. Corner gas station, snaked with dusty cars, slaking thirst, owners just as parched. It's Sunday, but everyone is looking down, away, distant from the low slung concrete walls, the wafting petroleum fumes, the rumbling throaty trucks, and VW bugs with curled lashes. Next door, if you look over, sits a drab house with antennae perched tight as an insect. On its desiccated patch of yard, bang against the peeling concrete wall, rises an astonishing coral tree. If you're looking, you blink twice. Check to see if you are wearing your rose-tinted sunglasses, but no, you left them in the driver's seat. You marvel at the red. It's not fire engine, nor some lurid logo designed to subconsciously prompt shopping for laundry detergent. No, it is fire in even flares of bloom over dark boughs, improbably reaching over the air and water station, confident in its living florets of blood spilled extravagantly for all. If you're looking, you sense serene roots held in being, lit by being. You catch the silent, steady burn of the blossoms, the outpouring of exuberant mercy. You want to remember this always, this red apparition, not for its existence, nor its flaming flowers, but because it chooses as its companions the empty tanks, the change oil lights, the flat tires, the ones who notice, and the ones who do not. It's a beautiful poem. You know, Mary this morning in her talk talking of the title Postmodern, right, in it, the title. This is a classic postmodern setting, right? We're at this derelict gas station in the desert. I'm from California, where Laura Rees Hogan is from. There are lots of these things on the roads. They're always ugly. It's a Sunday, but it's a Sunday devoid of any kind of religious meaning. It's just another day at the gas station. The VW bug with the curled lashes, kind of the absurdity, you know, of our contemporary culture and its habits and its tastes. And in the middle of that, though, come two epiphanies. The first is, in the middle of that scene, you have this beautiful coral tree, right, which sheds down these beautiful blossoms over a scene where the tree does just not fit its setting, right? The tree is offset from it. It's like, wow, that is a gorgeous thing in nature. But then, in almost a Gerard Manley Hopkins-like move, that tree in nature reveals something else, which is the presence of some kind of Christological meaning, significance, right? Something redemptive about the tree's presence in that place. The tree is there, not for its flaming flowers, but because it chooses its companions, the empty tanks, the change oil lights, the flat tires, the ones who notice and the ones who do not. Something about the tree that is there giving beauty to those who notice it, but also and especially those who don't. It's a tree that holds open redemptive arms, a double epiphany. All right, what does this mean? Why do I bring all this stuff up? There are kind of three points I'll summarize here about this. First point is that there are really wonderful theological concepts to which Laura gives expression here, and that find their way into the poems here. But the two things work differently. This explains how theosis works. This, the poetry, enacts for us the force of revelation, some kind of disclosure in the moment. Wow, that's what that is. I see something different. In essence, this book is about Paul. This is Paul's apostolic journey. This is like Saul on the road to Damascus. Something strikes us and says, hey, you. Look here, look now. You know, what is this? To the degree that theosis does inform the poems, it wouldn't be so much as an effect what the poems actually generate. They generate more like revelation, epiphany, than they do theosis. But there is something very informed and, I'd say, spiritually sophisticated about the poet's perspective, about the learned rhythms that she's acquired to understand what a spiritual experience is, how it happens, to whom it happens, when it happens, why it always takes us by surprise, even if we think it's going to occur. There's always an excess to a spiritual moment that exceeds our powers of anticipation. This is a poet understands that kind of experience. That's a product of our own experience. Theosis, right? A presence of, not the very enosis, the presence of God over time, path of discipleship. But also, I'd say, there's also a familiarity with the very rhythms of poetry. Poetry is a discipline that whose language forces us to pay attention. Poetry is an art of attention. It's a technology of attention. It says, pay very careful attention to sound, to form, to figurative language. When you see these things in poems, it's a poem's way of saying something extra important is happening right here, right now. Do you recognize what it is? Are you spiritually adept and attuned enough to recognize what kind of meaning is occurring here in this moment, right here, right now? So, with that as backdrop, can we just read and discuss together that other poem in here, The Language of Open? And I'd like to know what you see going on in this poem, why you think, or how you think this poem gives expression to spiritual experience. Can we have a reader besides me? Who would like to volunteer, if you would, for our group to read this poem, The Language of Open? May I ask? Anybody? Thank you.
At the very center, pistil to petal, you remain in my rose, all fragrance. You are honey and lemons in my tea. I know your knock on my whittled down hut of abandonment, abode of withered hope, the disappointed country cut hard to stubble. The language of open is not spoken here, but one of a bitter kind, biting, not abiding. You know your knock on the black uneven timber of my last door, the one I cannot see, the one built by those neglectful architects, the grasshoppers, when I wanted, oh, I wanted the butterflies. I know your knock. You know my wooden knot, a hurt resistance, a sullen, swelling silence. You subdue, you submerge with your peace, honeyed fingers and citrus smile, balm of Gilead. So much adoring poured out, overflowing my teacup, my acorn of anguish, the very universe brought to bear, to touch, to hold, to cure my cold, to coax apart, to warn, delight, to cross over a forbidding threshold with rush of winged light, unweighted. I forget. Honeybee gold in the glow of coming free, my petals reach wide, soak sunshine, unfurl the incense of an answer, open the drawbridge, spilling out one short syllable of surprise dawnbreak, surrendering the lot, joying in loss, flaming into the splendid bloom of yes.
Thank you. You're a very fine reader of poetry. That was lovely. How much time do we have, Chris?
We've got about 3.5 minutes.
Okay. Let me ask you, right? If I asked you how this poem defines, characterizes spiritual experience, how might you respond? What has spiritual experience been defined in the poem's terms?
This morning, but his recitation really touched me. For me, it was a prayer. At the end of it, I said, "Amen."
Mm.
It was a prayer, really, that he was saying.
Thank you. Thank you. It was beautiful, wasn't it? It was lovely. I think it was a nice thing to bring poetry into the conference. Others? Yeah, please.
Something that struck me is just the setting of it. I think towards that end, we have an answer. But it's set in paradox.
Yeah, good.
And I think that's often how spiritual experience is begun.
Nice.
You know, it's
nice.
A setting up. I'm not getting on at a lack of answer. There's a lot of, I mean, she's a river of Carmelite. There's a lot of jhana pras, shakti, the beginning of it.
Good.
And so, yeah, I think the paradox is the setting of something that I know is there, in a sense, but is that I have no access to as kind of the background.
Love it. Thank you. Great. Anybody else? Yeah, good, right. In fact, that's captured in the very title. Notice how the language of open is almost like a solecism. It's ungrammatical. Language of openness, right? So it breaks the grammar down. It suggests this is an impossible locution. It's incorrect. And yet, it happens, right? It's perfect for the poem. There are two, there's a version of this paper. It's going to be a longer essay. And it goes into kind of a more philosophical vein as to what Christian poetics. I think Laura is one of the finest modern Christian poets. And by the way, there are a lot of contemporarily really amazing Christian poets writing at present. It's a resurgence of work in Christian poetry. Laura, I think, is especially a good one. But there's a way in which these poems work in some ways alongside but also at odds with the conventions of poetry that define poetry more broadly in the literary community that I find really provocative. And the paper I'm writing is about that. But the point I make here this morning is just that there's something about the poems that do cause us to slow down, to pay attention, and to recognize the way in which the pulsations of spiritual events and experiences happen in ways that can make us more attuned to have these things happen for ourselves in our own sphere. And that is my presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we can continue the conversation. We've got 10 minutes to come up to lunch. We've got our three speakers in the room still, so it's just an open moment for any comments to any of the three connections we've made. I'll open the floor. Thanks.
The imagination, you know, I talk about imagination and that it, and I talked about it in a more abstract way, but each of these presentations incarnates imagination as a skill and a tool, I guess you could say, for that availability to God, but availability to the conversation of the ultimately of the earth, but of whoever is present.
Experience.
Yeah. I have a question, and this is kind of for Mary, but okay, but and maybe Matthew is going to jump in with this because that's just really interesting to be talking about Christ personally in nature and then in relationship. And I thought, especially the filling tree, and it's very kind of Hopkins, the moment where my gut is that the tree is personally Christ for it in this moment, in this tradition. And that there's kind of there's a hermeneutics, there's an interpretation to it. So I feel like some of what you were talking about in your talk was kind of almost like the ontology of that how do we understand the person of such that Christ could be himself in this way? And here's almost an enactment of it, but I was just wondering more about, I guess thoughts of how that's discerned, maybe effectively embodied here, but there seems to be kind of this is too big, but questions of kind of the hermeneutics of that. How do we, maybe poetry trains us to do it, or but any thoughts about maybe it goes to the imagination, but I'd just love for maybe both of you kind of expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I think you said it, and I don't want to distract from this conversation, but I love your interpretation. That's a Christ person, which clearly, in order to say that, there's a whole tradition that we bring to be able to say that. So, but that it's a primal reality which we then can, as you say, interpret. Yeah, in that way, yeah, more primal than our interpretation. Yeah, but anyway, I defer to the speakers here.
Well, no, it's great, Mary, and I appreciate the question a lot. I think what you said at the end is really good about the form of poetry. there's something about the forms of poetry that create, they kind of set up certain kinds of expectation, and certain frames for interpretation that are inherent already in the structures themselves. Here, unrhymed tercets, where meanings kind of unfold in certain kinds of ways. And so the attention is drawn to ways that the form breaks out. Yeah. How you have enjambment across a stanza, right? Or kind of the stanzas aren't rhyming, kind of small rhymes inside of the lines to say, hey, wait, stop here, pay attention. I guess there's something kind of liturgical for me about poetic form, in that it sets us up to be able to experience things in a certain way. And when something breaks out from that expected form, you have then that moment of aha, epiphany, oh, hey, this is different. Something at the angel of the altar, right, suddenly appears, right? And that's the effect for me of poems. These are the very structures they create. They interpret, and then they depart from the interpretation, and that's the moment of new life.
Would you like to say a word?
I think I'm experiencing that from inner wisdom circle. The unexpected comes, and it conflicts or it resonates, and you deal with the emotion. And when you were asking your question about poetry, it's words that touch the heart for me. So it can be in prose. It's poetic prose is also an aspect of it. But I think that we have learned to hear at a certain level, and we're wanting to solve everything. What we need is a depth thing that just holds it and see what emerges. That's my comment.
Thank you.
I guess that's why I use the image of the dance in my talk. It's, as I said, it's something that makes me very uncomfortable. I don't understand dance. What I do understand about dance is that there are set structures and routines to it. And if you watch Dancing with the Stars and, you know, they get a step wrong, whatever, it's criticism about you not within the design structure how to do that dance. I want to set that against the perichoretic dance, which is a dance that is flourishing with some kind of meaning-making of our interaction with God and the world, but there is something disruptive about it. There's something very organised and curated about how God operates and how God wants to interact with us, but it causes us to stop and pay attention because there is a dynamic here of God continuing to move and shape and create some other kind of dance that we are invited to participate in. So it actually jars us a little bit. And yeah, I like how that interacts with what you're saying.
Thank you. One more comment or question before we finish. Thank you.
I can't help but say that the interrelation between Mary's talk this morning and poetry now, especially in relation to indigenous cultural practices. So particularly like that story, poetry on Earth and Fire. So like if you go up to Northern Territory, so north of Australia, during the wet season, the Ojibwa Aborigines are actually park rangers. What they do is they control the scrub and manage it from having really serious bushfires by actually igniting bushfires themselves every year. And so in the same sense as poetry, it doesn't actually consume the forest, it just consumes the undergrowth. So there's no consumption of the forest in the process, and some seeds don't grow unless there's been a fire. So it actually breathes new life after a fire. And so just like then looking at these three poems, each of them sort of has that undertone of enhanced gradient without consumption. So, you know, you've got the tree that's beside the service station, that's not consuming the service station, that's next to it, adding to the radiance of an otherwise ugly service station, just like the forest, during the fire, it's radiant, and the char creates new life, and it becomes even better than it was before without consuming the forest. And the same with language of open, so you've got, like honey and lemons and tea, it's still tea, but it's made more radiant by honey and lemons. Or the wooden knot on the door of the hut, the hut's still entire, but it's more radiant by the sound reverberating inside the hut. So, just awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful, yeah. Any comment from our speakers to conclude?
That was great.
Yeah, that's...
I used to be a firefighter, and so I understand in the Australian context, it's required because life can't flourish without the final sacrifice.
Well, thank you, Di, Mark, Matthew. Wonderful presentations. Let's show our appreciation. Thank you very much.